Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. I'm joined today by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
And today we're going to do something a little different, a little fun. We recently asked patrons to ask us questions, and today we are doing a live Q&A where we are going to go through and answer a bunch of these questions. So we are live to patrons right now. If you are listening on the podcast, don't worry, we're going to read all of the questions out loud, and if any questions come in through the chat, we'll make sure to say them out loud so you can follow along. Yeah, and so we have a bunch of questions to get through. I'm excited and I'm nervous. How are you guys feeling?
Terrified.
Excellent. Okay. Anything else before we jump in? Let's do it. Okay. Yeah. So our first question comes from Sarah Beebe. What were your first projects together? How did you become a team? The LFTS origin story, basically. How did we become a team? So early on, I started Lessons from the Screenplay. It was just a solo thing. It blew up. It was kind of crazy. And so the first year, 2 years was me making videos and slowly burning out and getting super exhausted. And Vince, our producer, having to take loving care of me and my frazzled state. And so pretty early, we were having conversations about building out a team and creating a group of people that could collaborate on everything to make the process less stressful and more fun and better. And so maybe we can switch perspectives. So Brian, what happened next from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, there's a longer version of the story, but the short version, because we have a lot of questions, is I did a good deed for a couple once who were strangers to me at the time, basically. But then I gave them a ride across town on a very rainy Halloween night when an Uber would have cost them $100. So we became Facebook friends and that was it. And then probably a year and a half later, a friend of mine sends me your Rogue One versus Force Awakens video. And I was like, I was writing very similar movie columns at the time. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. I should maybe reach out to this guy and see if he wants to like meet up or figure something out. And then I find you on Facebook and we have exactly two mutual friends and it's that couple. And of course that helped me kind of get the foot in the door a little and be like, hey, I'm not a total psychopath. I know people, you know. And then you and I met up and then it kind of went from there. But, you know, I like telling that story because it's just like a nice, like moral fable, right? It's just like, I did something because I was just like, you guys are in a crappy situation. I would love to help you out and I can help you out. And then that sort of not entirely indirectly led to basically the course of several years of my life changing drastically. So it's pretty cool.
That is a nice little, moral fable. Yeah, I remember getting drinks with you and like getting beer, and I don't drink a lot. And I just remember being like, oh man, I'm really drunk already. I hope this person doesn't think I'm crazy. So you came on board and Collateral was the first video we worked on.
Yeah, together. Collateral. Yeah. Yes, for sure. Which was cool. Mostly me kind of slapping words together and then you taking it, turning into a real video. And then No Country for Old Men came from there. And then I think Shaun of the Dead, I think, was the first one that I felt like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's the video that I kind of like originally pitched and like had like some agency over. But yeah, it was a lot of you and me sending long emails back and forth and talking about strategy and drafts and all that kind of stuff.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. And so to switch perspectives again, Trisha, what happened next from your perspective?
Yeah. So then it would have been in 2017, I think, in October, that we went to a wedding of some mutual friends of ours. And like, I already knew you. I don't remember where I met you the first time, but I knew you already. You guys came to my play. Anyway, yeah. There's a lot. We had mutual friends. Yeah. So right. I'd met him a few times. But anyway, at this wedding, we ended up sitting together and like talking movies all evening and just connected. And then I realized that you live really close to me, actually. And so we started hanging out a little bit. And then at some point you were just like, do you want to write a video for me? And I was like, sure, let's try. I like didn't even watch video essays at that point. So I was like, what are these even? But yeah, then I pitched and wrote the Jurassic Park video for the channel, which was a hell of a lot of fun. That was a really, really good video, and also lulled me into a false sense of security because Michael didn't edit it hardly at all. He was like, no, this is great. This is awesome. And like, you know, it wasn't an arduous process in the script phase. And then it just became a video and it was great and easy. And that's how they got me.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. And like behind the scenes with all this, there's always like me talking to Vince being like, I met this person. I think they're cool. And like, I know this girl, Trisha, I think she's really smart. What do I do? And like Vince being like, be a person and just be fine.
Talk to her.
Yeah. Right. Awesome. Okay. And then Alex, how did you come on board?
Well, I've known Michael since film school, so we go way back. But at the time, yeah, during your LTS like origin time, I had taken this detour into politics for a couple years and then burned out on that. And then I was like, I need to get a job. And so I edited a Netflix show called Evil Genius. It was a limited series. And that was like a very difficult but rewarding project. And coming off of that, I was just like, man, I want to get back to just thinking about, you know, narrative stuff, writing, directing, yada, yada. And Michael at that exact moment was bringing on Brian and then Trisha and kind of expanding the LTS team. And so that's when we started talking and I was looking for my next kind of editing gig, whatever. And working with, you know, my best friend was sounded like a great thing to do, even if, you know, the money wasn't great compared to Netflix. but I was excited to have a place on this team. And so I think Jurassic Park was also my first video. And that was a great entry into the LTS world because, of course, Jurassic Park is like the origin for so many of us of loving film. So I, you know, I already had every frame of the movie memorized in my head. So editing that video was so easy. I could like literally jump to a frame of the film like by feel in the timeline. I was like, yeah, that's where the T-Rex steps out of the fence or whatever. So that was a great first experience. And then eventually I kind of got looped into the writing team as well. And we were all one big, sometimes happy, sometimes fighting family. And and then we did the podcast and it's been great.
Right. Yeah. And then, forget it was like not that long after we were all working together that the idea for the podcast came. It was like, I think we're all kind of hanging out at my apartment, just like in person, we're going to talk and be people, and ended up talking about movies, obviously a lot. And then, somewhere in there, it was like, maybe this could be a podcast. Like maybe we have smart things to say sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I initially pitched the podcast as just sort of like a little extra content for Patreon or something like that, because we spend so long working on an LFTS video and then so much gets left on the floor. There's so much we end up talking about and then we turn it into like a 9-minute video. So it's like, oh, like Trisha and Michael should just do like an hour on Jurassic Park where they talk about the process of writing the video, or Michael and I could talk about Collateral. And then it turned into like, well, what if we just actually did a podcast where like the four of us come together and actually kind of talk through the movies and talk about lessons and all that kind of stuff. And then it quickly became, we don't have to have done a video on this movie to actually talk about it. We can just talk about whatever we want to talk about.
Yeah. So that's kind of the story. The name for the podcast, Beyond the Screenplay, is something that I believe Vince had cooked up like early on into LFTS. I'm just like, at some point, you got to do a podcast. We got to call it Beyond the Screenplay, which brings us to our next question. When is Vince going to be on the podcast? Vince, when are you going to be on the podcast?
I'm never going to be on the podcast.
Great. Moving on to our next question. GE asks, so this is kind of a three-part question. So first of all, have you seen Arcane? If so, episode when? I have seen about half of the episodes of Arcane, so I'm still making my way through it. I'm really enjoying it. It's really cool. Have you guys seen any of it yet?
Mm-mm, but it's very high on my list.
Same.
Right. Okay. So stay tuned, maybe, but it is good and there's definitely interesting story things to talk about. Part two of this question, can you describe how you select which movies you discuss on the podcast? And are there any movies that have been vetoed by another member? I can volunteer movies that I've vetoed later, but Brian, can you tell us how we select movies for the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, the cool thing is, for as far into the podcast as we are, there's not just sort of like a dry, like, well, this is the next one on the list kind of thing. It's sort of an organic, like, what are we feeling, you know, right now? And I think it's the main, I would say, points are what is being talked about right now, right? So, of course, we just did, like, The Matrix trilogy or, you know, something like that. Like just what is out there and either in the news or there's a new thing coming or whatever. That one's kind of an obvious one. And then just stuff that one of us or multiple of us get like an itch to talk about. Like we have an episode of Up in the Air coming out soon, which was just like Michael being like Up in the Air. I'm like me being like, yeah, like, right. We just all sort of one or multiple of us like, that sounds great. That's exciting. Let's do it. And then we do have, I think Vince is the one who sends out the sort of Google form to give us recommendations and stuff. And I've converted that into a spreadsheet that sorts by like movies that have had multiple votes and stuff. And then the four of us can go in and X which ones we're interested in. And then I resort it. So it's sort of like a manual upvote system. So, you know, we did that and movies like Knives Out were super high on the list. And like, we're like, well, we all want to talk about Knives Out anyway, so let's do it. And then, yeah, I mean, I think like in terms of vetoing and stuff, like if three of us really want to, usually the fourth one will stick it out. Or if they just really don't want to, then it's like, okay, is that person out of town and we have a guest and, you know, whatever. So I think we just find ways to do it. But then, you know, I think Alex and I are kind of down to talk about whatever. So Alex and I are going to start a podcast called Alex and Brian Get Weird, where we talk about like Ari Aster and David Lynch and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, right. Please.
Michael and Trisha, I'll just have a Michael and Trisha stay safe.
Yeah.
That's our podcast.
It's just that thing you do every right. Every episode.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Michael, do you want to list any movies you vetoed?
I mean, some names. Yeah. Once looking over the spreadsheet, I was like, oh, I said no to Mulholland Drive, which I'm more open to now. I don't know that. But Monty Python and the Holy Grail, Hereditary, and The Goonies are examples of movies that it's not.
Don't hold your breath, everybody.
That's not going to happen.
Beyond the pale for Michael.
Okay. So now we have some kind of questions about like the creative process and stuff like that. So Weston Hustis asks, when y'all are in the process of writing your own material, at what point do you open it up to critique? Bonus question, who's your favorite Spider-Man and why is it emo Tobey Maguire? I think actually Andrew Garfield is my favorite Spider-Man.
Wow. I agree with that. Not my favorite Spider-Man movies, but my favorite Spider-Man.
Yeah. But yeah, so during the writing process, when do you ask for feedback? So feedback is really important. I think we've talked about that a lot. And I feel like there's kind of, in my mind, there's sort of two approaches and it can kind of depend on the person and the project. I think sometimes it can be really great to get feedback early and often if you are psychologically have the constitution to deal with that. but I also think at some point in any project, I find that I hit a wall where all the, you know, going over the script again and doing another pass and doing tweaks, at some point you reach diminishing returns and it's like you've lost objectivity and I don't know if I'm making it good or worse anymore. And I feel like that's the sign where you like, you definitely need feedback at that point because you have to have another person's perspective to help shake things loose. So I think there's lots of different ways to do it. And that's how I, you know, that's when I know it's time for sure. But earlier in the process, if I can, if I feel like it won't disrupt things, I like to get feedback early. What about you guys? Anything to add?
I mean, I think for me, an approach I think I've been taking with our most recent project, Michael, is just wanting to at least get like the first draft of the script to a place where it's at least reflecting accurately the intent and like the vision. So that if I get feedback on it, it's not already like lost in translation of like my intent isn't even clear because I want somebody to read what I've written and understand what I'm going for. And if that's not even clear, then the feedback I'm getting back may be on a different idea than even the idea I'm trying to communicate. So So it's a tricky balance because you don't want to agonize for months and years on a first draft that is then going to maybe change entirely because a core structural weakness is identified. But I think I have gotten feedback sometimes on an idea when it wasn't like fully baked yet, and it's like the people reading that are reading something different than even what I intended, and I almost didn't give the idea that I was trying to put forth like the due diligence to have a chance at life before it was like kind of torn apart because I didn't even like get to that stage. So that is part of the tricky balance is like, how much do you want to invest into a first draft or whatever kind of first pass at your idea so that it is clearly the idea you want to put out into the world, and yet you haven't like staked your life on it for way too much time, so that when the core issues are identified, which usually they are, you're not just so devastated that you just give up and walk away.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that ties into this idea also of like, depending on who you're getting feedback from, someone can only read your thing for the first time once. So
right.
Kind of like curating that first experience sometimes is a consideration.
Yeah. I think for me, it obviously just depends on the project and like what it's for. And I think that that's a really big thing to consider. So like when I was working on developing a spec with my manager, I was getting feedback from him constantly, like even just like on seeds of ideas, because with that project, we had very specific goals in mind. And so it's like we were even, starting even in just like premise ideation phase, like working with my manager, because it was like, we have to have this and this and this for sure, or it's not going to achieve the goals that we want to achieve for it. And then we continued working from there. So, and then of course, you often, if you are working with other people because you are, this is going to be made, or you're developing it with, producers or whoever, those people are there every step of the way too. So I think it just is like, what is the end product? Like thinking about where it's headed and then who your partners are on that journey, and like, making sure that you're always pointing towards the end goal, and having those people, in the car with you while you're driving on the way there. And sometimes, sometimes there's a phase of the process where those people can take a nap and you're just driving the car by yourself for quite a while. And then sometimes like they're constantly helping you navigate. So,
yeah.
Trisha watched Drive My Car last
night. I really did. It's so long.
It's so long.
It's so beautiful. It's 3 hours long. But anyway, car metaphors.
I'll just add to that very quickly. Like for me, it's just when I don't know what to do next. And sometimes that's a good thing. It means I've read my script twice and I haven't made any big changes other than little tweaks and stuff. And sometimes it means I know there's a problem here. I'm not sure what it is, or I don't really know how to solve it, and both of those cases, it's great to have other people read them and give you feedback. Cause if you think your script is great and people say, here's 10 notes, that's great too, because your script, as you were kind of saying, Alex, like your script is already strong enough that reworking it and stuff shouldn't be as hard as if it's really sloppy and you don't know kind of where to go. it's still in very early phases.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just the more you write and the more you get practice at getting feedback, you'll kind of figure out for yourself when and how. And yeah, the best way to do that. Now, more than ever, people are working remotely and having to share files across great distances. And if you work in video production, like me, odds are those files are pretty large. And odds are that you need to get them to the recipient as soon as possible. That's why I recommend checking out our sponsor for this episode, Massive. Massive is a file sharing service that lets media professionals quickly transfer terabytes of data to anyone in the world over the cloud. With Massive, there are no limits to the amount of data you can send. And Massive has 150 servers worldwide, which means whoever you're sending the file to will be able to download it at a maximum unthrottled speed. Transfers are encrypted, so no one but the sender and recipient can access the files. And sending files with Massive is super simple. You don't need a subscription to sign up or a complicated IT setup. Just pay as you go at 25 cents per gigabyte. To learn more and to sign up for Massive, Head to massive.io/beyond-the-screenplay. When you sign up at that link, you'll get 100 gigabytes free towards your transfer. That's massive.io/beyond-the-screenplay for 100 gigabytes free. The link is also in the show notes. Thank you to Massive for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Now, back to the episode. Okay, so our next question from, I'm going to say this wrong, Kirti Vandavili is definitely not right, but that's what I said. He says, or they say, hello from Nashville. Question, when you write or shoot a project and you are attracted to various types of applicable aesthetics, how do you choose one consistent style for the entire project as opposed to a mixed bag of diluted styles? And then he also says, thanks, P.S. I'm from India, and I began and binged this podcast while living there and traveling 2 hours every day for college. I have to say thank you, guys. You're reaching corners of the world that you would not even anticipate, primarily because of the quality and earnestness of your discussion. So a big hi. So that is super sweet. Aww, and thank you. Like, so amazing to hear. Okay, but yeah, so when creating a project, how do you arrive at a consistent style? Trisha, I feel like you have a thought.
I do. And the answer is like theme, obviously. And I talk about theme all the time. But to me, theme should guide every single creative decision in a project. And like thinking about why you want to make this, what is it about for you, like deeply and truly, and then using that to make sure that every single piece is designed so that it is serving that theme. And that a lot of that goes back to genre, right? Like theme is always embedded in genre. And like we film noir is about a certain kinds of themes, and like Westerns are about certain kinds of themes. Action movies can be about certain kinds of things. And so making sure that like you are using cinematic language that's rooted in cinematic history. And that's what genre is, right? It's like we make a finite amount, usually, of kinds of movies, basically. And that might feel constricting, but it's really freeing, right? Where because if you're working in a certain genre, and not that genres can't be blended or played with or whatever, but like you're operating using existing cinematic language to get the audience into the right mode that you want them to be in to receive your story. And so starting with genre, starting with theme, and then using that to like whittle down and whittle down toward like, what are the stylistic choices that are going to best serve this and have the effect that I want to have, want them to have on the audience. And so I think, yeah, it's, obviously, style is like another huge question to begin with. But I think that's where I always go to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really smart way to ground your decision making in something like practical and functional, of like looking at what is your story, what's going to serve that the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alex, thoughts?
Yeah. You know, that's like the definitely the like the place where you should start is in these big picture questions about what is the goal of this film, yeah, thematically, genre goals, all that stuff. And then for me, when I'm kind of like in the thick of it, when I'm in the midst of writing, once I've made those bigger decisions, it actually sometimes helps me, because I'm a very musical person and kind of think in music, to make a playlist that actually has a really consistent kind of feeling tone that lines up with that genre, with that thematic kind of, it's almost like, yeah, trying to put like music to that logical decision that was made, actually helps me stay into kind of a certain mindset while writing a script, which kind of helps create a tonal consistency as I'm writing. And then when it gets to actually shooting something, then it really is all about just like in every moment of this story, how is the way I'm shooting this supporting, you know, the theme, the character, the information that needs to be communicated right now in the plot. You know, information is not just communicated via dialogue or via an action happening. It's also being communicated via the lighting and the shot composition and the camera movement. You know, that is all information on top of the kind of just pure content. So that's also just like, yeah, when you're shooting something, you know, every style choice should be enhancing and supporting the story you're telling, not cutting against it, unless that's like part of the intent. But there's a very unnerving feeling you can get in a film when the style does not seem to be like in sync with the rest of the thematic or character content. If it's cutting against it, then you're not, it becomes an incoherent kind of experience.
Yeah. And that goes back to, I think, like doing some research and again, going back into like history, like find your comps, you know, pick three movies that you want your movie to be like, and be like, it's going to be like this and this and this, and then watch those movies over and over and over again and pay attention to what they're doing in those three movies. If that's how you want your movie to feel, like pay attention to the shot composition, pay attention to the music and sound design. And like, those are the kinds of things that are going to give your film the texture of these other films. And again, you can blend like from different genres and different ideas. And having those references for yourself is going to really help you. And they'll also help you pitch your movie. Like if someone wants to know with the style and tone of your thing, we did a Stranger Things video about this exact thing. It's like Stephen King novels and it's like 80s movies. And it's like, here it is. And then here, those are the comps or the things that you want to like blend together.
Comp standing for like comparisons.
Comparisons, yeah.
Right, yeah, lingo term.
Yeah, I'll echo both of those, which is to say, I also make playlists when I write and I listen to the same playlist in the same order every time. So it's like, I feel like your body and your mind get into a place, you know, and it's like, it knows it's time to keep working on this thing and very much matching the mood of whatever I'm making. I love making little like pitch docs and slides and things like that to be able to show someone like, this is somewhere between Freaks and Geeks and The Breakfast Club, or this is somewhere, you know, this is something. And you kind of like, you can think of those almost like pick four movies and put them as like dots in a square and then stay in that square basically, right? So if you're like, I want it to be kind of like a Charlie Kaufman, Wes Anderson movie, well then you probably don't have like poop jokes in there, right? But then if you're like, I want to make a zany comedy, then like you don't want to have like a gory death scene, right? Like you kind of want to figure out the boundaries of what you're working on and then just try to stay inside those boundaries. And if you go outside those boundaries, make sure it is for, as you know, as Trish is saying, like a thematic reason or a strong story reason. Like there's a reason you weren't expecting this kind of thing to happen, but that's actually what makes it compelling.
Yeah. I will also say Pinterest has become one of my favorite places because that's it's really just cute. So good.
Oh, right.
I like that image. And then it's like, here's a million other images. And they're like, yes, that and yes, that. And it's really easy to get to go down a rabbit hole that is maybe unhealthy, but that can helps me anyway, figure out visually, mood wise. Okay. Yeah, no, it's like, it's kind of like that. It's kind of like that. And then at the end, you have this board, kind of like you were saying, Brian, collection of images, aesthetics that help you explain it to yourself and also explain it to other people. And all of this also kind of ties into another question that we got from Jazz Jack Rabbit that was essentially asking about style over substance. And I feel like kind of what we're saying here and the big takeaway is that when done well, style can be substance. Like I think that's kind of a false duality. And so kind of like you were saying, Trisha, like interrogate the style of other things that you like to figure out what are they using that style to do, so that you now have those tools to say, okay, now I know how to use those styles to enhance the substance of my story.
Yeah.
Yeah, like real quick, I've been thinking about that with movies that are in 4:3 aspect ratio recently. And like most of the time, I can exactly point to why. Like, what are you trying to do thematically and mood wise, you know, to make me feel a little more claustrophobic during this movie, The Lighthouse or First Reformed or something, as opposed to we did it because it's cool and weird. And like, that's an artsy thing to do, right?
Right. Okay, awesome. JMW Music, who I also see is in the chat. Hello there. I have a 45-minute commute and catching up with the podcast keeps me going. My question is this. We hear so much about the story circle and the fulfilling hero's arc, etc. What are some movies that you think are successful in spite of having a flat arc that defies a lot of the good storytelling principles we hold so dear? First of all, I'm just going to say Sage from the channel Just Write has a video called Writing Characters Without Character Arcs. And it's basically all about the flat character arc and uses Cam Weiland's book, Creating Character Arcs. That's I've said that so many times. And examines, yeah, her breakdown of a flat arc. And so, like, one of the examples is, like, a Back to the Future or Paddington, where the movies are, it's not about the characters changing. It's about how these characters change everybody else around them. And they're kind of, like, the rock, and everybody else is the thing that's going on the arc and being changed by the interactions with them.
Yeah, I think I compared Paddington to Elf when we did our podcast, which was both movies about just, like, this very sort of happy character who feels like unearthly positive, but then it, like, they shape the characters around them by not changing, by sort of refusing to like adapt to real real humans, basically.
Yep.
What about Bob, maybe, as an example?
I was gonna say, what about Bob?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fun one. Yeah, any other examples or thoughts that we can think of?
Yeah, I was also thinking about A Clockwork Orange, which is a movie where, spoiler, where the character doesn't change, like, is unable to be changed at the end. They bring him in and try to make him stop being this terrible person that he is. But the end is like a celebration of the fact that he's not, which is a super dark ending. But then you start to realize, like, oh, right, this is a commentary about sort of free will and the society surrounding the character and that kind of thing. So I think, like Paddington, it's a movie where the character's refusal to change is the point, you know, and I think that's where flat character arcs are. You have movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark where they're just not that interested in a huge character arc. But I think there are the movies that are most compelling are movies where the character's refusal to change is either a positive or negative thing that the movie is trying to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, chat just shouted out Knives Out, but also Nightcrawler. I think Nightcrawler's
Nightcrawler's a great example,
yeah.
Really good one.
Awesome. Okay, so Andrew asks, if you had to pick five movies to watch, not just have on in the background, but to watch once every month for the rest of your life, what would they be? So five movies that you have to watch once a month for the rest of your life. Alex, what are they?
I mean, it's hard because, like, even the best movies at some point, yeah, I don't know. But I'll go with my gut. So here's what came to the top of mind. I just watched Children of Men last night because I'm preparing for another podcast called My Favorite Movie. Children of Men is just like, it's the kind of movie where every time I see it, I've seen it so many times, I'm pausing to look at details in the background. I'm hearing new, like, audio details in the world of the film. So that film, I can just watch over and over again for just the amount of information that is packed into, like, the cinematic language. It's just fun to keep seeing new layers and how just amazing it is. The New World is just, like, I think a very relaxing and beautiful Terrence Malick film that also has great romance and drama. So I can just kind of simmer in that world over and over again. Eternal Sunshine. I'm always good for some good, just like feels, some good heartbreak feels. And so I can probably watch that one over and over again. I was trying to think of, I can watch like BBC nature documentaries over and over again, but most of those are TV shows. But there is a film documentary called Oceans that was made by a French filmmaker that got distributed by like Disney in the US, but it's on the same level of just like the most insanely gorgeous ocean cinematography with beautiful music. So I'm fine to watch that over and over again, no problem. And my last one was just a kind of a random gut decision, but I Heart Huckabees is just a movie that just tickles me, and I just kind of love living with those actors in that world, and so I think I would enjoy just going there over and over again.
Nice. Great. Cool. All right. Brian, what about you?
The easy answers for me were Labyrinth, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which are just movies that I love dearly, but also I just find them to be so entertaining and so watchable. And like, they put me in a great mood, but also I just never get tired of them. I'm never like, I could watch that again. I'm like, yes, I could watch that right now. And then Big Lebowski, I think, is another one that's up there. And then I had like Fellowship of the Ring or and Empire Strikes Back as options, but then I was like, I kind of do like being able to save them for I haven't watched this in 2 years and I'm ready to kind of go back in. So So yeah, I don't know what my fifth choice is, but it would, like, I certainly wouldn't mind if it were something like that. But then I sort of doubted myself because I was like, no, I like, there is something nice about restraint, right? Where it's like you wait a long time to watch something or listen to an album or play a game. And then when you finally do again, then you love it. So that's my cop out of not having a fifth choice.
Great. Okay. Trisha, what about you?
Let's see. I picked initially a couple of like classic films that I just will watch because they make me happy, like Singing in the Rain. I watch a lot. Casablanca, nice. I watch a lot, but that's also one of my favorite movies ever. And then there's some action movies that I could watch pretty much infinitely. So like Casino Royale, I think, is one that I watch like over and over again. The Matrix is another one that I would watch like over and over again. And then I didn't really know. I had a hard time deciding what I was going to give the last slot to. It's probably Jurassic Park, which is my favorite movie. So I feel like I could watch that every month just about. But yeah, you know, I have other like really favorite movies like No Country for Old Men and stuff. But I don't know if every month, if that's like every yeah, month movie. It's quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that fifth slot is a tricky one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I might say Blade Runner for my fifth. I'm just like looking at like movies that like, I just like being in, you know, being in the world, and could do that a lot.
That's Michael. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, so my gut just started typing stuff was The Force Awakens, Ex Machina, Seven, and oof, When Harry Met Sally.
Real chaotic over there.
Yeah.
Yep. This is my brain. And then, yeah, the fifth slot. At first, I wrote Up in the Air because we just talked about that. And I love that movie. And then I was like, what about The Hunt for Red October? But then I was like, wait, no, but really every month? And then going through our list of episodes now, I was like, the favorite? Maybe I could watch The Favorite.
Yeah, I maybe could, every month.
Yeah. So I'm going to go with The Favorite.
Nice.
Nice.
Yeah. It's an interesting thought exercise that every time these kind of like, yeah, the desert islandy questions come up, I get tense of like this comes up so often that my brain is like, do I need to be preparing for this? Like, is this an eventuality that is going to occur? Because everyone's talking about it a lot of the time.
Yeah, right. A situation in which you have nothing except for five movies.
Right. Well, right. That's what I liked about this question, because that's the normal one is like, you could only watch these movies. But I like this question was like, you can do anything you right. want, but you have to watch this, like each of these movies once a month. I was like, ooh, that's an interesting take on the sort of desert island thing.
Cool. Okay. So we got several questions about the Oscars. So we're kind of just going to roll them all into one big question. But yeah, from Tariq and Abel and Aaron McCombray, multiple people asked about the Oscars. So generally, what are our thoughts on the Oscars, I guess, as an institution and on the nominations this year? Trisha, take it away.
Sure. So I'm known among friends and family as like the Oscars super fan. I haven't missed the Oscars since 1992.
Wow.
That was a little while ago.
It was. And, you know, I think one of our patrons asked, like, you know, do we care about them? Or like, are they worth caring about, basically? And the sort of answer that I give to people when this question is raised, because I think it is it's a common question, it's a valid question, is two things. The first is that in every single industry, pretty much, the industry will come together and award excellence within its own industry. So if you are a vacuum cleaner salesman, then you can win a vacuum cleaner salesman of the year award in your industry. Apparently, the 1950s over here.
But I'm sure there's a conference that you go to.
No,
for that.
I'm sure there is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the idea that, like, in the entertainment business, the Oscars are like special or unique is not necessarily true, is what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to raise with that, which is that, you know, not every excellence in an industry award thing is televised. And obviously people are not famous. I don't know who the vacuum cleaner salesman of the year was last year, but like,
it was my dad.
Mr. Bittner. but, like, there is a good and standard, well-established practice within an industry to award excellence within itself by people, you know, that understand what the job takes and what it means to be good at the job and what it means to advance the industry. And that is what the Oscars are designed to do. That's what they were created to do. Now, so I think that that as a principle is a good thing. Like, people do innovate and they do push the envelope and they do create new technology in the entertainment business. And they do, you know, give landmark performances and they do release movies that change the way that we think about movies. That's all excellence that exists within the entertainment business. And the idea that the industry itself would come together and point to these things and say, this is new, this is different, this is excellent, this is outstanding. And we want to just say that to the people who made it is a good thing. So that's thing number one. Thing number two is, although the Academy Awards does not always recognize every instance of excellence, and some of the films that they do choose to recognize as being excellent are perhaps not upon reflection, they do still matter. The Academy doesn't always get it right, but what it chooses to honor actually is really important in terms of who is going to go out from this place, go out from the Oscars, and get more opportunities and get to make more movies. And it is going to direct the direction of the industry, where it goes from here. So, like, you know, maybe you don't think that whatever should have won Best Picture. Well, okay, that's, you might be right about that, actually. But the people who made that movie probably are going to get some more opportunities to make more movies, and you are going to have to see them next year, the year after that. So, like,
you're not selling me on this, Trisha.
I'm just saying, for good and for bad, right?
Yeah.
A movie like Drive by Car that's nominated this year, you know, is a Japanese film starring people that we might not be familiar with. And we might get to see them in new things and get to see more from this director that otherwise might not have gotten distribution. And so that really matters going forward into the future, that it has an Oscar nomination. And so, like, I don't think the layperson needs to care about the Oscars if they don't want to. But to say they don't matter, which I know that's not what our patron said, but, like, I think that question does get raised, like, do they matter?
Yeah.
Yes, they do. They really, really do. In terms of where do we go from here? The Oscars is like a signpost that tells us where we go from here. And so it does, if you care about film, it matters a great deal for that reason.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I think the nice thing, and also the problem sometimes with the Oscars, is that it can be sort of this, like, echo chamber of, like, here are the 12 movies we decided are the Oscar movies this year, and all of the, like, all the nominations are going to go to those same 12 movies, right? And a lot of them are the familiar director who, well, we didn't give them Best Picture 3 years ago, so I guess we'll give them a nomination this year. It starts to feel a little insular, but to Trisha's point, then you have the Parasites and the Drive My Cars and the, you know, Worst Person in the World, who, like, they get in. And then when they get in, then that's a huge thing, because then now that filmmaker or actor is being sort of elevated to this kind of new status, right? So I think there's a downside where it's like Nightmare Alley, I thought the movie was fine. I didn't think it should be a Best Picture nominee over something like Lost Daughter or Come On, Come On. That's my personal opinion, obviously, but it does feel a little like, oh, it's the guy who we gave Best Picture to a few years ago. I guess this should be nominated for Best Picture too, right? It starts to feel a little kind of repetitive in that way. But I genuinely, my top five of, you know, most years have a lot of Oscar nominated movies in them. I don't arms folded, like, oh, that's the mainstream movies that, like, the squares care about, you know, like, and it's also, as Trisha was saying, it's wonderful to see people that you care about getting celebrated. You know, I think it was like Frances McDormand, Gary Oldman, and Sam Rockwell all won Best Acting Awards in the same year. And it was just like a little present that someone handed me, right? And it was like, here are all your favorite people, and they're all getting awards. So that's fun too. And it's just a nice kind of guidepost, I think, every year to be like, if you're trying to figure out what the movies from the previous year are, you should watch. Like, that's a pretty good starting point, you know. I also like to look at other lists that other people have made and try to see what is on the most. But the Oscars is certainly a very solid starting point.
Yeah. And it's a great way to, it's kind of what you guys are saying, but to kind of take the temperature of the movie industry.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To just kind of sum it all up of like, Parasite won Best Picture. That's news. Like, that means something.
Right.
That says something about where we are and stuff like that. So yeah, definitely has a function. Do we have any particularly interesting thoughts on the nominations this year?
I mean, I think it would be really fascinating if they gave it to West Side Story, because I can't think of another instance in which a remake of an Oscar Best Picture winner from 1961 was remade and then was also like excellent. I haven't seen West Side Story yet because I really want to go to the theater and do it right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that would be just like a very interesting turn for this year if it went that way. I think, as I always say, like, if you want to know what the real Best Picture nominees are, look at the Best Director list. So, you know, they nominated a full set of 10 this year, but they usually really only nominate 5. And so those are kind of...
Yeah, you can always name 3 or 4 that are definitely not going to win.
Yeah. ever since they expanded it back out to 10, but still only are nominating 5 directors, it's like, we know. So yeah, you could take a look at that. I'll be curious to see how it goes. Yes, obviously I'll be watching. I think there's a live watch along also going to happen on the Discord. So
yes. If you're on Patreon, join us on Discord. If you are not, join us on Patreon.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. The Patreon Discord is a crazy place. Ooh. And an amazing place. They've started to self-organize. There's a book club. There's like watch alongs happening that I don't even know are going on.
It's out of our hands now.
It's pretty amazing.
I think they're building an army.
It's
there's a whole
beautiful community, you guys.
It is. No, it is. I talk about it in fear, but that's only because I'm so in awe of it.
Yeah. Self-organizing magic.
Sentient army.
Yes, it has become sentient.
Hello, everybody. Michael here, joined by Alex.
Hello.
And this episode is brought to you by Mubi, which is a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the globe. And Alex is here to tell us about one of these exceptional films that you can watch right now on Mubi. Alex, what are you going to tell us about?
So I was really excited to discover a movie on Mubi that I could not find anywhere else, which is an IMAX documentary called Voyage of Time, created by Terrence Malick.
Oh.
And this movie is essentially the evolution sequence in Tree of Life, but expanded out to a 46-minute IMAX presentation. You know, it's basically, if you were wondering why there was the evolution of, you know, consciousness and life in the middle of a movie about, like, a kid in Texas, this kind of removes it from that context and just makes it a glorious, you know, poetic vision of the history of time by Terrence Malick, with Brad Pitt narrating. Wow. And by narration, I mean whispering poetic phrases occasionally about, you know, what is life and what is choice and what is consciousness over strange and beautiful images of evolution, including the bad CGI dinosaurs you remember from Tree of Life, but so much more. And Mubi is even presenting it in glorious 4K. So highly recommended if you want kind of a weird, wonderful Terrence Malick history lesson. And you truly cannot find it anywhere else. I have tried. And I'm so excited that Mubi has found it and is giving it to us.
That is amazing and sounds totally bonkers and awesome. Yeah, I mean, so Mubi, if you don't know, every day Mubi premieres a new film, from brand new work from emerging filmmakers to modern masterpieces by some of today's greatest icons. There's always something new to discover on Mubi. And each and every film is hand-selected. It's like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime, anywhere. Very personal in the case of Alex, that he can't find anywhere else. To try Mubi for free for 30 days, simply click on the link in the show notes. Or if you're watching on YouTube, click the pop-up in the top right of the screen, or simply head to mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. That's mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay for a whole month of great cinema for free. Thanks to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. And now, back to the episode. Okay, well, really quickly, we also had a question on what films are y'all looking forward to this year? We were talking about this briefly earlier, and Brian knew the answer for me, and I think for all of us.
Yeah,
so Brian
will
what,
tell us.
Yeah, what are we looking forward to this year?
Well, I just looked at my list and then applied them to you guys. So I figured Alex would be looking forward to The Northman, the new Robert Eggers film. Trisha and I are both going to be looking forward to Thor: Love and Thunder for sure. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse Part 1, they're doing the Dune. And then Michael, I figured you'd be looking forward to Top Gun and Black Panther. And I think we're all looking forward to Mission Impossible and Jordan Peele's new movie, Nope. And yeah.
Jurassic World Dominion.
Sure.
Yeah. That goddamn trailer.
Some people will see that.
It made me say, I guess I'm going to see this movie because I feel like I want to, which
Ellie
is
Sattler.
A weird feeling.
Alan Grant.
This is why you don't watch trailers. Speaking of trailers, we have a question from Evan Westman. What are each of your favorite trailers? And while we're at it, what trailer did you feel most betrayed by upon seeing the movie it was advertised? Yeah, I Alex, I know you love trailers. What did you end up with here?
Well, I was thinking back to, what was the first trailer that I was like obsessed with? And I think it was for The Lost World Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Because I think that was like early internet days. So I was able to get a tiny like QuickTime video that like very slowly loaded so I could watch it over and over again. But
right.
I believe I saw it in theaters for the first time before a screening of Volcano, the Tommy Lee Jones movie.
Which is amazing. Oh my God. Can we talk about that?
I would love to. I mean, I watched it again recently. Man, the visual effects do not hold up. but seeing that trailer in theaters was just the most amazing experience because, of course, I was already obsessed with Jurassic Park from a few years earlier. It had made me want to become a filmmaker. And now here was new Jurassic Park content in a legitimately good trailer with, like, I think music from The Rock or something. It was, good trailer music, amazing shots of T-Rexes chasing people and Velociraptors jumping out of the grass. And I was just in heaven. And so I watched that trailer a million times. But later on, I think Inception is a landmark trailer of just being really super cool and establishing the Hans Zimmer blah sound that is mandatory now in all epic trailers. And then we've also talked about this recently on the Matrix podcast, but there was that magical moment when they were announcing the Matrix sequels and just had a short teaser announcing both titles and showing just select images from these upcoming movies. And it was just the most wonderful, amazing moment.
Maximum hype.
Yeah. This is, it's like everybody's answer, but I really can't think of a bigger trailer to movie disappointment than Prometheus, where it is just one of the best trailers ever, maybe. The way it's cut, the sound, the music, it pointed to like just an amazing, amazing sci-fi movie, and the movie itself feeling so disjointed was like, wait a minute, but the trailer promised like such craft, such mastery. Why does this movie feel so like weirdly sloppy while looking so beautiful? So Prometheus, I think, still remains the like weirdest, like, what? Mm-hmm. This trailer promised so much, and what is this?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to go with Prometheus for most betrayed, but then decided last minute. No, actually, Rogue One, the deepest betrayal for me of... Because
shots in the trailer that aren't in the movie.
Exactly.
Like, that one's literally just...
Right. Lied.
Lies. But it's an amazing trailer, but it's full of lies. Right. Yeah.
Oh, hold on. Sorry. JMW Music. I have to point to that one as well. Yeah, there was like one of the first trailers for Interstellar, not like the final trailer, but they used that V for Vendetta music track, which is like cheating. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of the most exciting moments in recent years for me as far as trailers, just because it you had Michael Caine's voice saying like something epic about the future of humanity with the V for Vendetta like swelling music and shots of like a ship in space, and I just I couldn't
do not go so gentle excited. Into that good die
exactly yeah like you can't get better than that
yeah good job chat
Yeah, I was going to, I had Prometheus and Rogue One on my list, and then X-Men 3 was also another one where it was like, I wasn't excited about like the director change and everything, but then the trailer came out and I was like, okay, all right, I'm on board. And then no good. But the trailer I always think of when people ask for a favorite trailer, it's sort of cheating because there's no footage from the movie in this trailer. But, and I might've mentioned on a Q&A before, it's called The Minus Man, which is Owen Wilson, like sort of a dark, I wouldn't say dark comedy necessarily, but like a dark, weird, quirky movie, with Owen Wilson. And the trailer is this couple walking out of a theater and the Minus Man is on the marquee and they are sort of discussing the movie and like, no, he did it because he loved them. And that's why da da da. And you know, we go. And then they're in a different location. And suddenly the sun comes up and the woman goes, and she runs and cuts to like a locker room. She runs in and she gets changed and she runs out into an indoor pool and she's dressed as a lifeguard and there are bodies floating in the pool. And then it says, The Minus Man. You could talk about it for hours.
Wow.
But I love it because it's so dumb and quirky and silly, but it so perfectly captures the soul of the movie without showing you a frame of the movie, because it is a dark, quirky, weird movie. That's not like, you know, a trailer I would recommend anyone make. But in terms of like, I feel like I know what this movie feels like, but without a single frame being spoiled, thumbs up.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Yep.
I was reminded of a couple of animated movie trailers that totally rocked me. And one of them is The Lion King, where they just released the entire like first 2 minutes of the movie or whatever, which is that amazing song, you know, Circle of Life. And it's like all that gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous animation, that incredible song. And then it like, you know, cuts to like, boom, The Lion King. And that was just the entire trailer that they did. And I remember sitting in the movie theater in probably 1992 or 3 or whatever it was, and just being like, what is that movie? I need to see it. And then I remembered too that they did, thank you, Larry. I was about to get to the Lilo and Stitch trailer, which was excellent. They did like a few of them. But yeah, and then they did a similar thing with Pocahontas, where they just released the entire like Colors of the Wind song. And that was it. They just showed the entire song, gorgeous animation, just like sweeping, you know, epic, beautiful. And then they later on, when they did Lilo and Stitch, they did these amazing series of trailers where they pulled in characters from other Disney movies and had them interacting with Stitch. And there's one where like Aladdin and Jasmine are flying on a carpet, right? And then Stitch pulls up in his like red spaceship and Jasmine like gets in with him and like leaves Aladdin and like rides off with Stitch. Anyway, they did, those are really fun as well, that were really like self-referential and irreverent. But yeah, animated trailers during the Disney Renaissance were just like, knock you over with how beautiful the music and the animation is. And it was very easy to, Larry pointed out, get your own movie is what Aladdin said to Stitch, basically, which, pretty clever. So, and then the other one I thought of was also mentioned in the chat. Ryan Spellman brought up the Logan trailer, which is one that I, pretty iconic in terms of adult movies that I remember seeing and feeling interested in.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like it's really quick. I want to mention Inception, obviously, the Force Awakens teaser.
Oh,
like, really did it for me. Like, that was like a big moment of like the first time you're going to see like what is new Star, like just so much anticipation. And it just like nailing it for me.
Yeah. Actually, on that note, part of those early like tiny QuickTime loading screen era trailers, Episode 1. Trailer begin with like the Windows desktop, like XP, like green hills, and then some spaceships like
come over,
rise above it, is also a formative trailer moment for me.
Nice.
Yeah. I watched a lot of Attack of the Clones trailers. I liked those trailers. Also just the Social Network and the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, David Fincher trailers.
Yeah.
Just like the editing is insane. It's so much fun. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good trailers out there. Okay, so kind of getting back to more processy industry stuff. Kyle Brewster, congrats on 1,000 patrons. My question is, what's the best way to get started writing and selling screenplays for features? he lives in Oregon, and is sort of considering there's like the more traditional like path of hounding potential managers with spec scripts and stuff, or after being inspired by Paul Thomas Anderson's filmography, he was like, well, maybe it's better to like produce my own stuff and get noticed that way. But so my first thought when reading this was we've talked to Sev Ohanian before, who's a producer and writer. We talked to him about Run, his movie that he co-wrote and produced. And one of the pieces of advice he said in that was that it's, people always say, you know, it's who you know in Hollywood, but he feels like it's more who knows you. And mm-hmm. I feel like that's a hallmark of this new era of like, it seems like you have to have a reason for people to be reaching out to you, because getting through all the gatekeepers is super, super difficult. So I would say that's my instinct anyways, anything that helps establish you and brings attention to you so that people want to talk to you is a good way forward, because there's a lot of people and it's hard. It's just a hard thing. But yeah, Trisha, did you have any other thoughts there?
I have so many, but I do want to echo what you said just there, Michael, because in this world where like you have to have something in your pocket already that, you know, makes you special or stand out. And so like you could write the greatest spec script ever. And you should do that. But then you also have to submit it to a screenplay competition and or a fellowship or whatever. And so then you can take that and be like, hey, I'm a Nichols finalist, like, or whatever it is, and have something that's attached to your spec script that is an indicator of quality. And so then you can say to somebody, oh, I won this competition. Oh, my thing, you know, was in this festival or whatever you made, you know, and we won this award. So having those indicators of quality is really important, or just being notable in and of yourself. Like, you know, part of the reason that I have the representation that I have today is because I was talking to various agents and managers, and the person that I ended up signing with was somebody who was a fan of the podcast and knew who I was before I ever like talked to him. And so that's, you know, it helps if you stand out in some way. Honestly, like social media, it's a drag to play the game, but like playing the game is, you can win it if you play it very well. So on various different platforms, like, you know, they talk about, obviously Instagram is like the actors and the models platform. And you know, if like it or not, Twitter is the writer's platform, because it's how you have to write tweets. And so that's not the only way to get noticed, but if you can do it well, you can. People are getting hired and fired on off of Twitter these days. Writers are, mm-hmm. Well and truly. So, but then, yeah, there's various ways in, you know, script competitions, fellowships, as I mentioned, making something of your own, if you want to have creative control over it, is a way to go. But then you got to go through festivals. And probably if you're doing that, you got to start with shorts. It's a long road any way that you slice it. And it involves a lot of writing, and it involves a lot of strategy, and a lot of just, yeah, pushing things forward into the world. Like, write them, send them to people to read, send them to competitions, put them on the internet, you know, put them on the blacklist where you can get graded by other people. And those are also indicators of quality. There are all kinds of ways to go. I think it just depends. As someone said to me, there are a million ways into the business. You only need to find one. But unfortunately, no one can tell you what your way in is going to look like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Off of that, I'll just add, like, make a bunch of things and do a bunch of things.
Yep.
You know, which is just like, have those things in your back pocket. So when they say this script is great, what else you got? You can say, oh, always. I can also do this. I've also done this, you know? And because maybe they don't want you to write that thing. Maybe they want you to write something that's totally different. So do you have a good sample of something that's totally different that you could do? But then also do a bunch of things. You know, if you know someone who's making a short film, ask if they need someone to come and hold a light or whatever, right? Because then those are people that you're networking with, and you're getting to know the other people who worked on the film. And the next time they're working on something, they might think of you to come work with them. And then you never realize how things can kind of spiral, but they spiral by you getting involved. Like, I can name so many things in my life that I've done where I had no idea it was going to lead to anything. And then it turned out to be like that skill that I learned doing this dumb thing for my friends ended up being so, you know, beneficial for me when I was applying to do this thing or, you know, whatever it is. So yeah, do a bunch, make a bunch.
Yeah, 100%. I feel like, yeah, what you just said, Brian, has basically described my entire life of like, I want to learn how to do a thing. I'm going to go do this thing that has no clear purpose. And then at some point later in my life, it's critical to being part of the next step I take in my career. So yeah, doing things, getting out there, as Tris is saying, playing the game. I also got a piece of advice recently from someone in the industry that was like, you know, essentially it was sort of try to think of how executives and other people might be looking at you and wanting to use you. And so sort of like, what is your thing? Like, if you're going to be put in a writer's room, what is the specific technique or, you know, skill that you have that's going to be useful in a writer's room? And if you're writing a spec script, a feature, like have a very clear genre, have a very clear form in mind, like know, make it really easy for whoever's reading it to see, oh, I could slot this into this, you know, open slot that I have, because that's the lens through which a lot of these people are looking at it. It's like, exactly. I need to fill this thing to make it really easy for them to be like, oh, I see how this thing fits into this slot or whatever it is. Godspeed. So we're getting almost toward the end. We just have a few questions left here. But so really quickly, a question for us from Gino Gonzalez. What have been some of the most difficult films to discuss on the podcast and why? So it's a really interesting question. And I feel like this is a part of our process and just becoming an important step in becoming the team that we are has been like navigating these things where sometimes, I mean, there's like, it's depending on how you want to look at this question. Sometimes it's difficult to discuss films just because they're so good. And it's like, where do you start? There's just like that, you know, mechanical level of like, what do we choose to cover when we're talking about Titanic, for example. But it's also been interesting, you know, having like, because movies are such an emotional thing and we all love movies and like the identity can be tied to movies and all this stuff. It has been like tricky at times to engage with movies where for whatever reason, some of us have a very strong like reaction to it. Baby Driver is one that I discovered. I had a very intense emotional relationship with, which is weird. And I kind of discovered that while we were recording the episode, which isn't the best time to discover that. But so I think it's kind of been, I think what's useful about this question is that it can be extrapolated into just like collaboration in general and methods to navigate that. And so I think for us, it's been like being really honest and a little vulnerable about like, here's how I actually feel about this thing. It might be completely irrational that I feel this way about Baby Driver, let's say, but for whatever reason, it's there. So let's talk about how to navigate that. Or maybe it just means let's not go there and then leave it off the table. So I think it points to that in collaboration, there is a certain amount of vulnerability that's required. And so I think that means you have to be brave enough to volunteer that. And you also have to be respectful enough to hold that for everybody else. And I think that's a critical thing.
Yeah, we've taken to kind of doing little like checks before the podcast, which is like, is there anything kind of problematic in this movie that could be kind of a landmine that we need to discuss or like, you know, figure out how we're going to navigate? And is there anything, any personal thoughts anyone has, like something that they really care about or really are, you know, don't like or whatever, just so we're all kind of on that same page. And just talking about it beforehand is helpful. As Michael was saying, just being honest with each other, I've said this about every, whether it's a roommate or a partner or a friend or someone you're working with, it's like just being honest about those dumb little things that bother you, like means that there's no pot that's waiting to boil at the end of 10 things that bother you that suddenly turn into something big, you know? So it's like, just be comfortable saying like, hey, that thing kind of bothered me or whatever, which, you know, we're very fortunate to not have had a lot of that, but part of it is because we all feel very comfortable like saying basically 100% of what's on our mind all the time, which means that we are always, you know, we're avoiding any big issue happening ever because we're always on the same page. And I think that's so important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to echo what you guys have said, I think that it took a lot of practice to like get your emotions out of the way or like check them at the door, put your analytical hat on. And like, this might not be the movie for you, but are there things to talk about? Right.
Right.
And I just want to reiterate that the practice piece, like you can't just automatically like turn your emotions down on something for the sake of like having a conversation about it in any area of life. Right. It takes practice to know how to do that and what you need in order to do that. And so a lot of the systems that we now have in place were not systems we had in place because we didn't have practice. We didn't know what we needed. And so, like, you know, there are plenty of situations now in which we can be like, hey, we're not going to talk about this aspect of the movie. We're going to talk about these other five things that are definitely worth mining. And this other thing, we're just going to leave it over there. And we don't need to get into it and stuff. And so I think that just going through the process many, many times of what's the most productive way to go about this is really key. And sometimes, as I think was mentioned earlier, sometimes we just can't. One of us just can't with a movie. And then that person is not on that episode. If the movie is still worth discussing and that person cannot, then they do not have to. And we will schedule it when they are out of town or something and bring on a guest. That does happen.
It's like when I reached my Marvel breaking point mid-episode on Captain America Civil War. It's
like Alex doesn't get to be on any more Marvel things.
I just had to like let it all out and it was maybe not productive.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have just a handful of some fun questions here. So we're going to kind of sprint to the end, I think. We're going to try anyway. Okay, so really quick. So Jeremy Trigstead, what is one novel, video game, existing IP that you want to see made into a movie? And also, what is your favorite drink? Brian, what IP do you want to see made into a movie?
Splinter Cell, I think, would be really fun. Tom Hardy is the latest in line to play Sam Fisher. I would like to see like a Clooney because the character's supposed to be older, but a nice kind of spy, you know, thing with climbing through vents and stuff. I've also always wanted to, my friend and I used to talk about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the book made into a movie. The movie is wonderful, but the book is told from Chief Bromden's point of view, who is crazy. So the book has things that he sees that are not happening. And we just said like a Terry Gilliam version of that or something like that would be just a lot of fun to see. And then I have a ton of other thoughts, which we don't need to get into right now, about other things I would love to see and how I would love to see them. Hitchhikers as a full thing, not just a movie, a full like limited series, etc. Favorite drink, bourbon, peaty scotch, an old fashioned, a high ABV barrel aged stout. One of those.
Trisha, IP and drink.
So I just have a bunch of answers that are like my favorite, like children's books and like YA novels that have yet to be made into movies. There's this book called The True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle, which is written by Avi. It's a book about a 13-year-old girl who, like, is crossing the Atlantic in the 1830s and, like, gets accused of murder. And there's, like, a mutiny on the ship she's on. And it's, like, it's a bunch of, like, Newbery Award winners. I should specify that I used to be a teacher. My mother's a children's librarian. So I secretly have a lot of a lot of favorite books that are actually like kids books and YA books. There's another book called Mara, Daughter of the Nile that I really love by Eloise Jarvis McGraw that I've always wanted to adapt. And there's just so many. For a minute, by the way, on True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle, they had Morgan Freeman and Dakota Fanning attached like back in the early aughts and they were going to do it. And I actually one time asked Avi in person if he was going to let people adapt it. And he told me no. To my face. And then I later saw that it was in development with Morgan Freeman and Dakota Fanning. And I was like, he lied to me, but then they never did make it. So I don't know. Anyway, there's lots of existing IP out there for like young adult novels that I really would love to see happen. Favorite drink? I don't know. I'm a bourbon drinker. So I've a bunch of those that I really like. And I'm also scotch and soda classic. Like, yeah.
Nice. Cool.
Oh, yeah. Madeline L'Engle's novels. They just did, someone in this chat just said that. Yeah, I'm also a massive fan of those. They did A Wrinkle in Time recently. It's not how I would have done it. But Madeline L'Engle also has lots of other wonderful novels that would be great books and movies, great TV shows and movies. So
nice. Yeah. I just finished playing Disco Elysium, which is a bonkers game. It's like, on the surface, it's kind of like a simple noir detective. There's a body found and you got to investigate it and figure out what's going on. But it's like, it's insane and you're maybe psychotic and you never know exactly what's real, because kind of like what you were describing, Brian, the other thing of like the protagonist is clearly kind of out of their mind. And so that colors the experience and it gets all existential and weird. And I think it could make for a really fascinating, stylized, but like in a very purposeful way movie. So I think there's like rumors that they might actually be trying to make it into a movie, and I'm in the right hands. I think it would be really cool. Favorite drink? I'm gonna go with Old Fashioned. Also, someone else mentioned it's good. I like it. It's like, the thing with Old Fashioned is that like it's really sweet and like nice to drink, but also it has this weird like, oh yeah, it's a cool like masculine drink thing or something for some reason. And so I've just like stumbled into like, I order an Old Fashioned and people are like, oh, interesting. I didn't think you would've been. Anyway.
Don Draper over here.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm gonna bring it to you with like a little pink umbrella though. Like,
that'd be great. that'd be cute. Okay. Favorite TV shows of the 2010s. True Detective, Game of Thrones. Sorry, this is from Mitchell Gregg. But yeah, True Detective, Game of Thrones, BoJack Horseman, Sherlock were some that came to my mind. Alex, what about you?
I'll add a Barry, The Crown, Succession, Broad City, Search Party. Some of my favorites.
Nice. Brian?
Yeah, also Game of Thrones and True Detective. I'll add Better Call Saul, Fargo, and I mentioned before the Australian series Wentworth, which just ended a couple months ago. I love that. And then the British panel show Would I Lie to You, which isn't a series, but I love it so much.
Nice. And Trisha?
Don't watch TV, but...
In the last decade.
I know. No, I mean, obviously, Mad Men is my favorite show ever, pretty much. And then, yeah, you guys mentioned True Detective, which I really liked. And definitely watched all of Breaking Bad. And, like, there were some good shows back then that even I could get on board with.
Nice. All right. Mo asks, what are some dream guests you'd like for the show? And congrats on 1K. Yeah, my first two thoughts, also because I was in the middle of watching the Social Network trailer, was like Aaron Sorkin and David Fincher. I'd still, you know, like bucket list. It'd be great to talk to them at some point in my life.
Intimidating.
Yeah, no. Terrifying, but fun. But then I was like, Bryce Dallas Howard. I want to talk to her. Like, I'm kind of obsessed with her and her directing right now. So that'd be fun. So that's me. Trisha, what about you? Dream guests.
Ryan Johnson. I would love to talk to him. I also just want to talk to him about everything, but Brick. I really want to talk to him about Brick and all kinds of stuff. Chris McQuarrie is another person I think would be just such a fun podcast guest to talk to. So, and he's so generous on social media with like sharing insight and advice, and like he's great. Right.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Brian, what about you?
All those, I'll just add David Lynch because I think it would be hilarious.
Oh my God. Sure.
The thing is, when you're making a movie, you have to look and find the place where you're going, and then you have to get there.
What?
Yeah.
We'll just have you interview yourself as David Lynch.
Perfect.
No. I want to hear you try to have a conversation with David Lynch. Oh,
boy.
Okay. Michael and David Lynch, one-on-one, talk about Mulholland Drive. Yeah. Let's do it.
What could go wrong?
Yeah. That'd be fun.
I'm gonna second Ryan Johnson. He just seems such a great guy. Yeah. I wanted to hang out with him. And on that note, I don't know why we talked to him necessarily, but Oscar Isaac, I just want to hang out with Oscar Isaac. Yeah. He's just the coolest person.
Yeah.
So
that'd be fine.
I would not say no to him talking to us.
I would not. Nope. I would not say no to him at all. Yeah. About anything.
Whatever he asks, the answer is yes. Yes.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Okay. So we're down to our last two questions here. So Bruno Augusto asked two questions. We're only going to look at the first one, I think. So what projects are you currently involved in? Where can I get more content from the Most Awesome Film/Movie team? Thank you, Bruno. Brian, what do you got going on?
As you guys know, I am working on developing a series about my formative teen years and the music my friends and I were obsessed with, and the girl who is still my best friend, who was the Winnie Cooper I was growing up with, and the band that my friends and I started, and sort of how all of that came together, and how it how I think it could translate into a really cool sort of Richard Linklater-esque series in present day. So that's been my thing that I am going to go upstairs after we're done here and hopefully finish my latest draft.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. Okay, cool. And Trisha, what do you got going on?
Oh, lots. Well, I have a movie about giant worms that's coming out pretty soon called They Crawl Beneath. You can check out whenever you're watching this, see if it's going to be... I don't have any information, any further information about where it's going to be streaming, but as soon as I do, I will get some to you. I'm also... always working on different assignments and things. I've recently been working on a mini series. It's like a historical mini series pilot that I probably can't say more about than that. But have really enjoyed working on that. We're probably in the rewrite phase on that now. Before we go ahead any further, and then I always have projects of my own that I'm doing, and I'm always talking to people and in development on things. I have a spec that's a producer is attached to that we're trying to get a director attached to so we can move forward on that. And many irons in the fire. That's kind of the way I think if you talk to a lot of screenwriters there, they have like eight things that they could tell you about. So,
yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's always like your answer when this comes up. It's like, well, I'm doing like 20 different things. And this book that I wrote just got published and this is happening and da da da.
It's like, Michael and I are like, we are still working on the same screenplay idea that we were talking about last year.
But you guys have made a lot of progress on your screenplay.
Exactly. Well, and right now it's my fault that it has not been shown to our friends because I did a full draft on it. Michael did a pass on that draft and tried a bunch of new things out. I am supposed to be doing like the reconciliation pass right now, but I went on vacation to Mexico and I started a new job this week at BioWare, which has been very cool. Yeah. So I need to finish my pass. So that is also what I'll be working on this weekend along with you, Brian. I need to finish my pass on our script so it can be shown to somebody. So that is what we are working on as a feature film script right now.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, that. And then last year I shot a music video with Maggie Mae Fish for fun. Alex was part of that also. And at some point I'm going to edit it, but it's this like insanely difficult task that I've given myself. It's like all editing and like every two frames there's a new cut and it's complicated. So that's like a mini fun project that I have going on top of that. And then some other exciting things that I cannot talk about yet, but we'll talk about at some point.
Soon. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Okay. And our last question, I believe the most upvoted question on Patreon, comes from Santos L. Helper. Santa's a little...
Great name.
Little helper. Hollywood Options, The Lessons from the Screenplay Story. Which actors play you? Who directs it? And most importantly, what's the midpoint? And a bonus question of what does it make opening weekend?
Okay. I don't like that last thing.
And then be depressed about it.
Streaming only.
Yeah. So like this is a really, I'm more interested, like I want to hear from everybody else, like listeners, what they, who they think should play us and all that stuff. Did you guys go through?
Whoa, Jason Momoa.
Alex, as Jason Momoa says, Adam.
My boy.
I did ask, like, yeah, some friends that are also listeners of, like, who they thought would play different people. And, yeah, apparently, like, casting you, Alex, was, like, the big struggle for them. Cheyenne Jackson was thrown out. What else? Oh, yeah, people, some arrived at Oscar Isaac as playing Alex.
Nice.
And I was like,
I will say, yeah.
He will be happy about that. But also Jonathan Groff, which I think
I did.
I would absolutely take that. Yeah.
There's a vibe. I love it.
If he grew a beard.
Yeah. But yeah, okay. So, Alex, did you do this exercise and what did you do? What did you say?
I didn't really think about it too much. I mean, I always jump to John Krasinski for myself as maybe he's a little too idealistic, but I think he's got, you know, when he grows the beard, we share some similar features and he's tall. Michael, you know, Jesse Williams, I think you guys, he could play you. I don't know about personality wise. I was thinking about, as far as like director, talking about Rian Johnson earlier, I feel like he could do a fun LFTS movie, I guess, you know, to just kind of, I would trust him to capture the spectrum of emotions that would fall into an LFTS movie. And Trisha, we talked recently about, you know, Emily Watson,
yeah,
as, you know, in Punch Drunk Club.
For sure.
Can totally see that. And Brian, yeah, who plays Brian? What do you guys think?
I don't know. Brian has an answer. I want to hear Brian's answer for himself.
Well, we did have a question in the Q&A that was, who would play us if we had biopics of us? And I said it would, you know, as much as I would like it to be a young Russell Crowe, it would more realistically be Seth Rogen, or you know, like a Jack Black or somebody like that, right? Just like a round-faced clown, basically, I think.
I can see Russell Crowe. I can see, yeah.
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 One of my friends suggested Daniel Radcliffe. Could be an interesting casting choice.
Wow.
I was like, I feel like there's a Daniel Radcliffe energy there. I think he would do an interesting take on Brian.
I see that.
Interesting.
Like lighter day
Daniel Radcliffe. Yeah, obviously, yeah. Not like, yeah, little boy.
Daniel Radcliffe. Oh.
Someone in the chat said Philip Seymour Hoffman, obviously, you know, nice. in a parallel universe. Yeah. I would absolutely love that. And then someone said Michael Caine as Brian doing Michael Caine. Nice. Say no to that.
Michael, I'm looking at your notes, and yeah. Carrie Mulligan and Florence Pugh both would be great for Trisha.
I will take it. Yeah, I get that. I get Carrie Mulligan sometimes, Michelle Williams sometimes, and basically any actress that's like ever had short blonde hair, people tell me. So there you go.
Yeah.
All right, Emily Mortimer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one.
Just all the Emilys.
Yeah, all the Emilys.
Got all the Emilys. I was also like, Carrie Coon, I think, could also like... play Trisha's character. Carrie Coon's really good.
Ooh, I like that.
I also was like, Jeff Goldblum as Brian, I think could be fun.
I like that.
I want to see that.
Energetically.
Oh my God. I asked Seth Rogen what he would think about playing me, and his response was...
Who should play Vince? When I was just free writing, I wrote down Willem Dafoe.
One of his like gonzo like A24 roles. Yeah,
I think that'd be fun.
Wow. Yes.
And as I was saying, I'm obsessed with Bryce Dallas Howard, so I would love to see a Bryce Dallas Howard directed movie about Lessons from a Screenplay. And yeah, the question of like midpoint, what would that be? And it might be, as we kind of went over the arc of things earlier today, if it was the full Lessons from a Screenplay story, the midpoint might be the podcast starting or like launching it. I don't know. Or like
that's the break into two. I think the midpoint is when we all realize some horrifying truth about ourselves.
Well, right. So has that not happened yet?
I think the midpoint hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's,
I mean, I don't think the midpoint has to be horrifying. I'm saying, I think there, you know, there may be a big something in our future that we don't know about yet. We're not keeping secrets that we don't know about yet. That will be the midpoint in the story.
Yeah.
All right. It's a little ominous. I'm afraid of midpoints, but if I have to live through them.
Spinning the story in an entirely new direction.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And as far as what it would make in the opening week, I did some math and we have, you know, 1,000 patrons or a little bit more now. And if everyone paid $15 to see it on opening weekend, we'd make $15,000 in opening weekend. So I think we have it all set up here.
As long as the movie cost less than $15,000 to make.
Yeah, we'll totally make our money back. Awesome. Okay, so I think we have managed to get through basically all of the questions. That was a lot of fun. Any other casting, directing things? If you guys were really eager to say anything else, cool, great. All right, we got it covered. Cool. Well, yeah, thank you, everybody, for listening. Hopefully this was like a fun little detour. We'll be back with our regularly scheduled programming next week. But yeah, thank you to all of everybody that listens, and then all the patrons that support the show, that submitted questions and upvoted questions. You guys are awesome, and it was fun getting to hang out with all of you and answer some of your questions. And we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.